My name is Rich, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of this group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have a list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that that what you learn here may be helpful to you in your recovery and or understanding. Alyssa will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Alyssa, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me this serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Ava will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Ava and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jane will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Jane. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related faculty or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, each AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is David.
Thanks. I'm Dave, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's January 7th, 2006. Rajesh is my sponsor, Atlantic Group's my home group, and I'm on step one. Let's see. Thank you, Drew, for asking me to speak. So, what it was like. I managed to get myself kicked out of two schools, pretty much. The first time I really realized that I had a problem with alcohol, I was on vacation with my family, and everybody had gone to sleep, and I was still wide awake because I had maybe a drink at dinner. And everyone was asleep. I would be in bed in full clothing, and I snuck out of the room, and I would go down to the hotel bar and order myself however many drinks it took to get me to sleep that night. And that happened for the whole vacation. I managed to get into a fight with every single member of my family, whether it be physical or not. It still happened. I was a pretty angry person. When I grew up in a great family, I was offered anything I would ever want and need in life. And I really have nothing bad to say about my family. My parents are actually here tonight, which is awesome. I went to great schools. I did everything I could. I was the youngest of three. I had the world at my feet, basically. And I decided instead to bury my head in the sand and hope everything would just go away. And that's really how I lived my life for the first 17 years of my life, just seriously burying my head in the sand, not addressing anything, running away, escaping. Anything I could do to get out of myself, I would. And I really hated myself. I really did. So I started drinking at about the age of 12. That was not enough, so I started some other things, which led to other things. The drinking was always there. And that's all I'll say about those other things. I managed to go to high school. I went to high school, did really well my first 2 years, then did really poorly as my alcoholism progressed. And I decided to transfer schools. I thought that would be my solution, and it wasn't. I managed to last 6 months at that second school, and at that point, I was really ready for help. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I was ready to jump out a window. I was like anything. I could not wake up another day and live the way I was living. And then I was asked to leave school on January 6th, I believe. And at that point, my parents were like, it's really time for you to get some help. So I went to a 28-day inpatient treatment center. I thought I'd be like 28 days done, I'm back, I'm good to go, I can drink again, so on and so forth. And then that led to 8.5 more months. And I spent 8.5 more months in a halfway house and sober house and managed to graduate high school, barely. And graduating in rehab is... And to barely be able to graduate in rehab is not good. So I get home from rehab, still crazy as can be. It got me away from the drink and the other substances, and that really was what it was good for me, because I could not stop on my own. No matter how many times I swore to myself, I'm not going to wake up and do this again tomorrow. I'm not going to wake up and do this again tomorrow. It happened every day. And at the end, it really was every day, and it was brutal. So I get out of rehab, I come home, I get a sponsor in name. I kept working 1-2-3, 1-2-3 for the first 2 years of my sobriety. But being sober in the beginning showed its immediate rewards. My father was able to hire me, and to be able to feel comfortable enough to do that after your son comes out of treatment is pretty impressive, at least for me, I thought. So I did that. I tried my hand at school again. That didn't really work out so well. I continued to do 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And about a year two, I was at that same place again that I was when I first got to treatment. Thank you. I was literally ready to jump out a window. I couldn't stand life. I had just fired a sponsor. I was sponsorless for about a month, and I was running my own show. And because I thought everything was great in my life, I had all these things. I had an apartment. I had my parent, like my family. Not getting into as many fights with my family. It was. I thought I had everything. And then I started working, and then I got desperate enough again to work the steps, and I did. I started working with a great guy, and I got through the steps, and I finally found a happiness that I'd been seeking all along, the thing that I sought so hard for, because I couldn't stand myself. I sought everything on the outside to fix that problem. I tried drinking, I tried spending money, I tried girls, I tried any power, whatever it was. I tried anything I could get my hands on to fix that problem, where only what I've found to fix that problem is the steps. And great things started happening. I got into another school. I started doing well in that school. I was able to travel. I was able to do a lot of things that I never thought I'd be able to do. I started enjoying life. I started waking up happy and smiling and not having this overwhelming sense of impending doom every day, and that was great, and I longed for that my whole life, and I had that, and then I went away for a few months, or for a month and a half, month or so, and I wasn't really thinking, but I started taking everything back. I started thinking that I had this thing licked. I had all these great things going on in my life, so everything was perfect again. And again, I ended up in the same place on my knees, just wanting to kill myself again, wanting to drink. I was at a point, it was my birthday, and I was like, I'm done with this program, I'm ready to drink. And this is 2 months ago. And it's really easy to get back to that spot if you're not doing what's suggested of you. It really is. I had no idea I was getting back there until I was there. And then I got a call from my current sponsor, Rajesh, saying, how are you doing? And I was like, and that was the night I was like, I'm drinking that night. And I mean, it was honestly a God moment that saved me that night, because I was done. I was. And then I met with him the next day. He was like, just don't drink for tonight. We had lunch the next day, and we had a really long conversation. and I stated that I was willing again. Like, I was no longer able to run the show. Like, physically, I was not able to do it anymore. I could not keep myself together. I couldn't keep anything straight at that point. So I asked Rajesh to sponsor me. And he gave me a list of, I think, 23 things I have to do on a daily basis to stay sober. Not even kidding. And I started getting back to basics. I was going to maybe three, four meetings a week. I now go to 5-7 meetings a week. just as a reminder, because it's not about me anymore. It really isn't. And like that was the thing, is it became about me again. And I was fighting everyone and everything. And the promises that I had once experienced were all gone. And again, it's very easy for those things to happen. And then I started hitting my knees again on a daily basis. I started praying on a daily basis. I was doing a daily 10 step. Thank you. And these are the things that I need to be doing on a daily basis, and reaching out to 3 to 5 guys a day, and speaking to these guys, because it's, again, it's not about me throughout the day. Like, I can't be thinking about myself all day, because if I do, I'll drive myself crazy. Because, I'm great, I know that, but I can't think about myself all day. And I started getting back into the book. And that was something that I let go of a long time ago. I hated being here. And now this is something I look forward to on a daily basis. This is my reprieve. This is my deep breath moment of the day when I'm here. And it's a great feeling to be here. So thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Lynn.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. It's really nice to be here, and I want to thank Debbie for asking me. It's really a privilege. I come here every Tuesday, and this is my home group. So I'm really honored to speak. I'll just tell you my story in 9 minutes. I grew up not far from here on Park Avenue. I didn't move there until I was 9 from the Bronx, so I always thought that was my problem. I didn't fit in. I felt like I was always kind of on the outside in a world of a lot of privilege. A world with a lot of money, and I somehow never felt like that's really truly what I deserved or knew how to handle. But I found the solution pretty quickly. I found it in eighth grade, and it was some concoction on the rocks with ginger ale, and I felt gregarious. I felt like I could talk to people. I felt like I belonged. I felt like I could be, if you were a deadhead, I was a deadhead. If you were a punk rocker, I was a punk rocker. If you were a debutante, I was a debutante. If you were at this club, I was at that club. I could be whoever you wanted me to be, because I had what got me there, which was alcohol. And alcohol freed me. So the thing that kind of saved me from a quick alcohol demise was my family. They kept me pretty insulated, and their approval was important to me. But when I got to college, and I picked my college, by the way, because it said it was the best party school in the Northeast, and I was like, great, that's my school. So I went to the best party school in the Northeast, and that's what I did. Every night of the week, there was a different theme depending on what bar it was, and I was a drinker. That's what I did. I drank until it stopped working, and until I woke up in the morning with shattered glass, a blurred memory of a violent fight with a boyfriend, and winding up in the campus mental health center saying, I'm deeply depressed. I can't stop shaking. There are mice crawling in my apartment, or I see them. I'm not sure if they're really there. She said, I want to talk more about that shaking and those mice, but I'd like you to fill out this pamphlet. And yeah, you know what I'm talking about. So I answered 24 of the 25 questions, yes. So there was clearly a problem. And I was whisked away very quickly by my parents to Gracie Square Hospital here in the city, and we took field trips to the 79th Street workshop. But the person I was really 12-stepped by was my campus minister, chaplain, who met me at that mental health center with a pack of cigarettes and a tin ashtray and told me his story. And I identified with this 50-year-old chaplain. I mean, I was like, I totally get, yeah, that's me. And he said, would you like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, okay. And we went to that meeting, and that's where I really believe God just like came, just like came into my life just immediately at that moment. I always get a little bit emotional because I remember it so well how I felt. I'm just going to speed up, but I'm just going to tell you that my life got instantly better. I mean, my dad used to say, you can't have a lower grade point average than you. How is it it's not even mathematically, he's an accountant, it's not even mathematically possible. And so I had that grade point average to then getting sober and, you know, graduating with honors, fellowships, opened up, graduate schools, careers. That was in 1986. And in 1997, I was, in 1990, I met my husband. I was 4 years sober. It was a blind date. He called me up and said, why don't you come meet me at this bar? And I said, okay, the first thing you need to know if you want to date me is I don't drink. And he's like, wow, I really like that. Okay, so, well, what do you want? You want to get coffee? Yeah. So little did this man know that 7 years later, he would be telling me that if I didn't straighten my act up, that my two children and he were done. And the way that that happened is, and I love what Dave said because I get it so completely. My life got better, AA got smaller, God was not around because guess who was back in charge? And what was going to fix me and my spiritual malady at this time, thank you, was the want of, if I get this, my life will get better. If I get this, my life will get better. If I get this, my life will get better. For me, it was, if I have a baby, that's just it. I'm a woman. I have to have a child. I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to on this earth to do? And that's it. And I went after that with such fierce abandon, like you cannot believe. And I met this doctor who said to me, you know, I'm not buying your whole infertility thing. I think you need to go home, have a big glass of red wine, and be with your husband. And I was like, yeah, that's a solution. And so I'm here to tell you that the first drink gets you drunk. And the first drink sent me for 10 years trying to chase what I had gotten in AA. It took a long time for me to get back. And I got back in 2007. And I got back the same way I got in, which was God, and asking for help. And there's a story in the big book where I wrote it down because I don't memorize things very well. But this, it's in one of the stories, and it says, one definition of a bottom is the point when the last thing you lost or the next thing you are about to lose is more important to you than booze. And that's what happened to me, was that I was at a career conference, and I humiliated myself publicly really badly. And I came home from this lost weekend, which it truly was, and I walked into my apartment, you know, like disheveled, and my husband not knowing where I'd been, and my three-year-old coming down the long hallway, kind of like this, like a long hallway, and coming up to me and saying, Mommy, you're really sick. And I hit my knees that day, and I asked God for help. And I tumbled down the stairs of the 79th Street workshop, and I stayed there, and I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous again. And then I heard a speaker at a fourth step meeting who spoke about her fourth step. And while I was sitting there, I realized, you know what? All my years of AA since 1986, before I went out in 97, I'd never done a fourth step. And again, I'm still willful. I say, that's my problem. I need to do a fourth step. I need to call her and do my fifth step. So she called me the next day, and I'm a newcomer. And she reached out to me. And if it were not for that phone call, I don't know. She really, and I said, oh, I'm so glad you called. I want to do what you did. I loved your story about the fourth step. I want to do it. Can I do it over the weekend, and I'll read you my fifth step? And she said, well, okay, if you want to work with me, my sober family, we do it, we start with step one, and we work through the way it's outlined in the big book. And then she said I could meet you at a meeting. And I said, okay, great, I want it, I want what you have. And she brought me to the Atlantic Group, and I've been coming ever since, and that was November 3rd, 2007. And my life has gotten so much better. I came in here filled with, I did not hold my head high. I was very I was very ashamed. I had so much shame and so much remorse and guilt. And today, I have to tell you, I have, oh, I remember Gina. I have so much willingness and faith. And I just, if you're here and you're hearing this message of Alcoholics Anonymous, or you're young and you think, like Dave was talking about, you've got this licked, just stay and be willing. I mean, thank you. I think the thing when my sponsor said to me, well, we start with step one, that was the first time that I was really able to take direction and do it the way that it's outlined. That was the first time. And I think the key to this whole thing, and not that I know a lot, but I'll just tell you my experience with it, is willingness. And I think, and it says it in the essays about the step three, but is the willingness. And I just have such great feelings about this group, and I think that if you're here, stay here. And I just want to thank all of you for my sobriety. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Sherman.
That's good. Hi, my name's Sherman. I'm an alcoholic. And just trying to look for some familiar faces here, get grounded a little bit. I shouldn't have said that. Okay. My name's Sherman. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm very grateful to be here today. I'm very grateful to be sober today. Listening to all the people counting days, this is a really great, safe place to be. And listening to all the people who are celebrating anniversaries in December, it reminds me that it's not getting any better out there because they couldn't make it to New Year's. And I got sober. My sober date's July 1st, 1990. I couldn't make it to the 4th of July. And I remember holding on to my seat on the 4th of July. I had 3 days. I'd been in out of AA at that point for about a year and a half. And if you're new, you'll hear a lot of suggestions. You'll hear a lot of people tell you all sorts of stuff. And my experience just for me was that I'm pretty sure I went out on every single one of them. People, places, and things. Hit a meeting every day. All the suggestions you hear. And I think that when I first came to AA, my perception was very twisted and distorted, and I saw the suggestions more as a hazing ritual or something, And the truth of the matter is that I really didn't know what was going on by the time I got here. I really, really did not know what was going on. I was out of my mind. And it's hard to, when you see all the, sort of well-put-together, attractive people that walk into this room, it's hard to imagine that we were all in shambles at one point or another. One of the things that I heard early on was that alcoholism was a progressive disease. That was something that actually once I sort of was here to stay, really made a lot of sense to me. Because my first drink that I drank was pretty much, one way or another, the same thing as what was in the glass of the last drink. But my life was completely different. I got sober 1 month before my 26th birthday, July 1st, 1990, I had growing up, I had had some really incredible opportunities that were given to me, and I had a good amount of tragedy too. And I was brought in, you know, my earliest memories of alcohol were going to holiday parties in Minneapolis, Minnesota, my aunts and uncles. And I came from a family where my parents didn't drink anything. They didn't drink a drop. But my aunts and uncles drank, and that probably had something to do with why my parents didn't drink. They weren't recovering alcoholics, but they had chosen a religion where there was no alcohol. And I grew up in a very pretty rigid religious family. And, we'll get to that later. What I do remember, though, is I remember a real sense from inside. I saw alcohol before I ever drank, and I associated alcoholism with total freedom. Not alcoholism, alcohol, with total freedom. And, one of the other things I remember is that my parents, though they didn't drink a drop, they would somewhere along the way, they had been given like a few bottles of alcohol, and they kept it in a little teeny cupboard in the corner of the kitchen. And I can't tell you where they kept the sheets in that house. But to this day, I know exactly where that cabinet was. It was almost like I had my eye on it, waiting for my chance. And, very, very briefly, I had a really, really wonderful first 10 years of my life. I had aunts and uncles and mom and dad and my sisters, cats, dogs, a country club. I was a want for nothing. And then, one day, I was in a foreign country in a boarding school, and I was completely cut off from my family. And that's not really to say anything other than I really, really had, I had a very, very traumatic thing happen at the age of 10 that really did shape my life. And, I picked up some very, very some character traits that really worked for me a little bit in that time. I learned how to become friends by people pleasing I desperately needed friends. It was an English boarding school, and if you didn't fit in, as someone said, if you were a nail sticking out of the wood, you got pounded into the wood. And it was at the same time we had a lot of fun. We got in trouble. My period there was really like, I remember at one point, after I'd been there, I was there for 3 years, after I'd been there for a little while, one of the teachers, after we all got in trouble, he said, "Ewing, come here." He pulls me aside. "I finally saw what happens with you." And he goes, "There's a little line here, and everybody walks right up to the line, and then you step over it." And, it was all kind of good-natured, kind of fun kid stuff, getting in trouble. And but there was also, I have to say, I was really, it was 1975 to 78. I was fascinated by English soccer hooligans. I was fascinated by punk rockers. We used to skip school and go into London, go to the football matches, soccer matches, and go to look at the punk rockers and look at the drinking, look at the fighting. And it was, big, 12-year-old, big-eyed kids into it, and then out of somewhere out of nowhere, one day, and this is the only time I ever did it, but we all decided to sniff glue, and then we did hyperventilating and passed out, and then we'd start smoking cigarettes, and as fast as possible, so we'd and then there was shandy beer, which was 0.0001 alcohol, and we'd drink it as fast as we could. Nothing would happen. Is anything happening? Anything happening? Nothing happened. But it was all warming up for when I moved back to the United States. I entered ninth grade, and all of a sudden, everything was new again. And all of a sudden, I had to try to figure out where I fit in with people, and I felt really, really Lynn said, I just felt the outside looking in. I just felt it didn't, You know, it just didn't quite feel right, you know. And you know, really, I mean, it's pretty simple. I went to, you know, went to a party, and there's this guy, Cam's concoction. That was maybe not the first time I ever had a drink, but it was one of the first times. And Cam went to his parents' liquor and, like, threw some gin, some vodka, some bourbon, some blackberry brandy, like, everything in a little bottle. And then we had a couple beers, and we take a slug and chase it down with a little beer. And we drank this thing, and what I remember, and I don't remember if it was from Cam's concoction or if it was from when we grabbed a six-pack and drank three beers, but what I remember is drinking them and, like, running out in the backyard and just being like, ah! And feeling great. You know, there's a slogan you don't hear too often these days: the alcohol gave me wings to fly. Then the other part is that it took away the sky, but that comes later. But it gave me wings to fly, and I felt like I fit in. And at that point, I was a controlled drinker. I was in ninth grade. That was the progression of alcoholism. I was a controlled drinker because what was really important to me was getting into a school, into a college, into a good school. And I made a deal with myself. And I don't think I ever told anybody my deal. And it was that I would not drink on a school night until I got into college, which got me into a good college, actually. But during my controlled drinking period, like one time a bunch of us drank, wine was the beverage of the evening, and I drank a bottle of wine, bottle of white wine, and when I woke up the next day, I remember nothing, 4 hours, blotto, and I remember and dry heaves and shakes and pukes and all that stuff, and I remember being very concerned, and something needed to be done, and I need to not do this again. And I'm sure that the next weekend warrior that I was, I'm sure I probably went out and did again. And I may have even not blacked out that time. But what had become really like this is bad, ultimately, in the progressive nature of this illness, became commonplace. I mean, like, I pretty much blacked out for 4 years of college. I broke the deal right when I got into college. I actually got my last application off, and the day I got my last application off, I was like, well, I said I was going to get in, wait till I got into school, but it's out of my hands. And at that day, I started drinking every day and using other things all day, every day. And that's the way it went from 1982, spring of 1982. The first thing that went was my drive to do well in school. Like, snap of the fingers. My experience was, and I know there's a lot of people who have different stories, but my experience was that my life stopped when I started drinking every day. The next thing, I drank through the summer. I got to New York City. That's where I came to school. I remember sitting in the library with a bunch. Oh, and 1982, when you got to college, they gave you a six-pack of beer when you walked through the door. We got a bag of stuff, including a six-pack sponsored by Bud Light. It was just, I walked through, I remember sitting in the library and the president of the university speaking, saying, around you are future leaders of countries and corporations. And I was just thinking, like, oh my God, what am I doing here? What am I going to do? The fact is that we are very resourceful people. I managed to, do pretty much anything to get out of the school. I pulled a bomb scare to get out of a test. People wrote my papers. People took tests for me. You know, actually, I'm not really proud of it. I missed an amazing opportunity to get a great education. And I was just blotto through the whole thing. I probably went maybe, you know, it would be generous to say 25% of my classes. And you know, the thing is that all the while, I was just, you know, the spiraling further and further down. You know, I started stealing a lot. You know, I started lying. I started, you know, and I actually, you know, and nobody, I never got caught. I mean, truth is, I never got caught. I was a great thief. And you know, the other part of it is that when you get sober, you know, you kind of have to go back and revisit those steps. So that came back to me. But you know, you can tell the story and you can tell the little anecdotes and stuff. But what happened very slowly is I stopped really, you know, I think people really generally cared about me, and I really stopped caring about myself, and I couldn't, you know, I just, alcohol took that away from me, I checked out, you know, and you know, in some places they'll talk about sort of your emotional maturity being arrested when you started your alcoholic drinking. I was like a, you know, 14-year-old trying to slug his way through life without a clue. You know, for all the nice things that I had material through my parents, like I didn't really get a lot of the loving and nurturing of things like learning to shave, learning how to bathe, learning how to balance checkbooks, open the mail, pay bills, you know, and all these things started happening more. You know, I swear my life was so unmanageable. My senior year of college, I had had a pretty intense relationship with my parents. My mom and I were very, very close, and she started looking like she was getting sick, and they didn't go to a doctor. Their religious persuasion was that they did not go to doctors, and so right before, you know, I was getting ready to graduate from school, except for the fact that I just didn't have it in me to pull it off one more time. I just did not have it in me to cheat, lie. I was beat. I was licked. I was at a bottom. I was in a definite bottom. And I was living in a house where I thought at any second I was going to get busted for being the guy who was stealing from everybody. I'd listen at my door before I'd run out, thinking that, they knew. Because everybody was getting robbed, but they couldn't figure out who it was. Then my mom was showing signs. So I dropped out of school 3 weeks before graduation. You know, my friends were like, "Oh, you gotta," and I was like, "No." And I moved home under the guise of going home to help around the house, when really I was going home to be a freeloader. You know, I kept, you know, I had a pretty expensive alcohol habit, amongst other things, at that point. I robbed my parents. I stole from my mom on her deathbed. This was 1986, She died in September of 1986. That night I was passed out. They couldn't find me. You know, she died a very, very painful death. You know, I don't want to get too morbid here, but, you know, I don't remember the last time I saw her, but I do remember nearly the last time, one of the last times I saw her. She had been a very beautiful woman, and she was ravaged by what turned out to be cancer, and she had had it for a year, and she had no pain medication, and she was in very, very bad shape. And I remember tears flowing down my face and feeling nothing. And that's what alcohol and drugs did, well, alcohol particularly did for me, was it was medication. It medicated me. How many years before was I running down the lawn, you know, spinning circles? Now I was unable to feel anything as my mother died in front of me, and I had just been stealing from her on her deathbed. That was 1986. I got a brief job. I went back, failed 3 semesters of PE, and then finally the guy just said, write a book report, get out of here, you know. And that was, you had to show up. Like, the only thing about PE, you had to show up. And so then I had a brief employment history in 1987, which was just a total joke. I mean, you know, some friends of mine got me a job in this corporation, and like, the lady hired me. I pulled on some, you know, BS, you know, I'm a college graduate, I have aspirations to be, you know. And so she, but hook, line, and sinker, and like, you know, the first day I showed up at 2:30 in the afternoon, and you could just, when I walked in, you could just see her face like, oh my God, I can't believe I hired this guy. And, you know, and it was just like, it was a comedy of errors. It was just a joke. And they kept me far longer than they should. They should have fired me that day, and I was probably there for about 5-6 months. Anyway, then after that, it was basically 2 years of using around the clock and in a little room. What I remember is, for example, on a holiday, going out, saying, I'm not going to do it today. I'm not going to do it today. I'm not going to do it today. I'm not going to do it. Lacing up my shoes. I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink. Walking out my door, which my dad was paying all my rent. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do it. Walking down up the block. I'm not going to do it. Not going to do it. Walking in the store. Not going to do it. Buying the alcohol. I'm not going to do it. Turning right back around. I'm not going to do it. Walking back up the stores, the stairs, closing the door, and just like, and just feeling like the world can just leave me the heck alone. Leave me alone. I didn't want to be around anybody. I felt like I'd been let down. You know, I felt totally alone. And that was the way I drank for the last 2 years. At one point, I went to a friend of mine's mother's house for, I don't know, dinner or something like that out in New Jersey. And she was driving me back to the bus, and I looked over, and on her steering wheel was a little fortune cookie taped to the steering wheel. And it said, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom no difference. And I looked at it, and I read it, and I was a really hurting pup at this point. And I just said to her, boy, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. And she said, well, that's actually the prayer for AA. And, you know, she actually worked in a rehab. And I think she gave me the phone number. I can't really remember exactly, but I think she gave me the phone number. Anyway, at some point right around there, I called Intergroup. And I was told about a meeting down at St. Mark's Place. It was 1988. St. Mark's Place was a circus. And it was, they'd say, leave your guns and your drugs outside, you're welcome, they're not. The first meeting I went to, I sat in the back, and a lot of people, like back then, AIDS was in the height of the epidemic, people were dying all around in these meetings. And I sat in the back, slouched, and the guy says, anybody new? And I'd heard people kind of lingo, and I was very hell-bent that I was going to be cool. I wanted to be like Keith Richards. So I put my hand up. I said, I'm an addict, even an AA meeting. And the guy threw, because a few other people hadn't, being a chameleon, I figured they were the cool ones. The guy threw a big book at me and said, welcome to AA. I just messed up your drinking. He didn't say that nicely. He used some profanity in there. So I just blanked up your drinking. And he threw the book at me. And, you know, it was kind of shocking, but he was right. You know, he was right. And that was my first welcome to AA. And if you're new, there's a very, 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 very good chance that your drinking is over. And whether you go out again, you know, you don't have to. You really don't have to. And, you know, I hadn't had a sober day in, like, a long time. And I saw people jumping up and down and clapping their hands, literally back down there at St. Mark's Place. They jumped up and clapped hands and ran around. It was like an insane asylum. But they were happy. And I learned about service. I learned about, you know, I learned about what I can't do by myself with another, you know, a group of people can. I can't get sober by myself, but with the help of somebody else, I can. And for me, I was very, very, I felt that God had ruined my life, or the notion of God. But all of a sudden, what I was being told was that, hey, who says God has to be this or that? You know, God, group of drunks, God, good orderly direction. You know, and the fact is I was hurting. When I finally was in and out of the rooms for a year and a half, my last time out, and then during that year and a half or so, I had had a day, I had 3 days. One time at St. Mark's Place, I went running out, you know, with everybody else. I was like, 10 days, double digits, you know. And it was a remarkable achievement for me, you know. But I'd keep going out. And I got 78 days. I couldn't go one more minute. And I was with a bunch of friends who were drinking who said that they wouldn't let me drink. It was totally cool. Don't worry about it. I had Diet Cokes. I was going to show them how well I was doing. Boom. Next thing you know, I'm drunk. I had 104 days. Same thing. People, places, and things. Last time I went out drinking... It was the same, you know, I won't bore you with the details, but it was like, you know, it was a disaster as any other night. And there was a guy at my home group at the meeting I'd been making the coffee for who had gotten my number, and he kept calling me, even though I was drinking. And he'd call and he'd say, listen, you know, you seem like a good enough guy. If you ever need help, you know, I'm here, you can give me a call. I won't make you go to AA, just, you know, we can just talk or whatever. And so anyway, I called him the next day after my last day, and we went, we met at 793 Workshop, and he spoke, you know, I told him, you know, my whole tragic life story, and he told me some of his, and we kind of threw some jokes in there. He played me like a deck of cards, and I asked him if he'd be my sponsor, and he said, you know what, why don't you go home, give me a call in a little bit. Four cell phones. And so I went home, I called him, and he said, and one of the things that happened was when I was telling him my whole story and he was telling his story, he goes, you know, you're saying a whole lot and you're not making a whole lot of sense, but I understand every word you're saying. And for me, that was when I had my moment of like, I got it. That's when I knew. He knew what I was talking about. He knew how I felt. He knew what I had done. And he was like me, and he could help me, and he wanted to help me. And at that moment, the gift is that I wanted to help. And so I called him, and he said, you know, if you want to be my sponsee, I'd love to have you. But I'm going to ask you a question. It's really important that you think about it. And he goes, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yeah, I am, you know. And he said, get a pen and paper, number 1 to 5. He's number one, get on your knees. And he's like, that. I don't want to hear about God. You know, just get on your knees and say help. You know, God doesn't have to come into this right now. Number two, read 2 pages of the big book. Number three, go to a meeting. Number four, call your sponsor. And number five, at the end of the day, get on your knees and say thank you. He said, that's what I do every day, and I haven't had to pick up a drink in 9 years. And he said, we're going to call that the 5 simple things. And when you call me, that is the first thing we're going to talk about. And you know what? That's what I do. That's what I did. And when I got 90 days, we did a 4-step. And I looked at all the bad things I had done. And you know what? He was like, I've heard worse, you know? And he also had me look at some of the good things. There's some good stuff there, too. And, you know, I give him my 5th step. You know, the real, you know, working through the steps is just really what's happened in the last 19 and a half years is that I've found a real freedom and a new peace and a new happiness. I went to my mother's graveside and I did a 9th step amend. and it was an incredible experience. You know, I went back to the people I stole from, and I made amends to them. There were some real doozies, and particularly, you know, I had the good fortune of robbing people that, the only people I robbed were the people that really loved me, you know, that really cared about me. And, you know, and, you know, I've really found a spiritual life that means a lot to me. And it may not work for other people, but it works for me, and it has to do with prayer, and it has to do with meditation, and a sense that it's okay, you know. I guess I'm just going to close by saying, when I first came to AA, and someone said to me, it's going to be okay, I really needed that, you know. Nothing felt okay up till that. And there was, it's going to be okay, you know. Allow us to love you until you can learn to love yourself. You know, back then they used to also say, sit down, shut up. We don't want to hear anything from you for 90 days. But that was back then. Times have changed. Anyway, I just want to thank Bob so much. I want to thank my wonderful friends that are here, my beautiful girlfriend, Jen. And thanks so much.